So thank you for three terrific and provocative talks. I have the privilege of, I think, moderating our panel discussion and questions from the audience. I think we've heard a lot about some different techniques, some risk calculators, some communication guidelines, and the ethical principles. So let's have I think we have about 20 minutes to have a discussion about how do we all do this in real life. One of the challenges that I frequently hear, and several of you alluded to it, is how can we ethically not do an operation that has some remote chance of helping the patient? So I think I'll start with Dr. White.
So I think some of the other, the two other panelists addressed some of this very eloquently. I mean, I think one of the things you have to do is see what the patient's goals are on this. Sometimes the goal is just living as long as they possibly can. Sometimes the goal is quality of life. Sometimes the goal might be, I need to live. I mean, I had a patient recently who just wanted to, live till her granddaughter got married in a few months. That was her goal. She wasn't really into the sort of 5-10 year survival from lung cancer. Whether that's right or not, or whether that was true or sort of a simplistic view from her standpoint, that's the way it came across. And then you have to sort of think about what's the best way to address that patient's tumor with a different timeline than most of my patients don't have that as a timeline. This woman did, but it's only through sitting down and talking to that person that you sort of have to come up and find a tailored approach to that individual patient. What we bring to the table as professionals is the expert knowledge on this. We bring to the table the fact that we have a better idea than the patient, for the most part, about what the likely scenario taken with this course of action versus the likely scenario with that course of action. And this is the whole concept of sort of shared decision making. And you have to sort of, it's a different age than when you just sort of said, you're going to have surgery next week. And they go, okay, fine, and sign the form. This is not now. This is not the way it is today.
Anyone else have comments? If not, I will go to the first question.
Hi, I'm Bonnie Condell. I'm an acute care surgeon in Riverside, California. What I encounter, unfortunately, too often is where I have a situation where I have very little information. For instance, a homeless person comes in not feeling well, no ID, somewhere between the age of 30 to 50, no real medical history, and then they acutely decompensate. When I meet them, they're on 2 or 3 pressors, have a lactate of maybe 6, a mild elevation of their troponin, glucose is maybe 190, still not getting very much information, and somewhere in that time they've had a CAT scan of their abdomen and pelvis that shows generalized ascites, diffuse bowel wall thickening of colon and small bowel. And when I examine them, I can't really get a good exam because they're either sedated or so acidotic that it's really hard to tell if they're peritoneal. You know, they've got maybe a somewhat of a firm abdomen, somewhat distended. And I just don't feel like risk calculators in that situation can help me very much. So what would you all do in a situation like that?
Challenge. So I think, as I probably alluded to earlier, I think most people want and value life. So, you know, lacking specific details about this person you can't communicate with, I think you have to make some assumptions. But it doesn't negate the fact that, you know, it's almost the equivalent of a time-limited trial, right? So you try something, you take them to the operating room, you do your exploration, you fix what you can, and then you reassess. And then maybe the next day, you know, family shows up, or you can actually try to have a conversation. And then each day, you know, I don't think it's a one shot, like absolutely not, or yes, I'm going to do it and go full court. I think you reassess it, and it evolves over time. So I think that, you know, in the absence of data, I think you have to assume that they would want full care.
Thank you.
And does that address?
Absence of good data, yeah, I usually look for it. follow-up. Is there a difference between this setting and the patient who keeps on using drugs? Aren't they both kind of falling through the cracks?
Well, I think there are certain definitely some similarities, and I think that, you know, in a situation like this where you don't have good data on the patient and you have to assume, I mean, I think it's fair to assume that they want everything done. Not everybody has filled out an advance directive. Not everybody has family available at the time. On the other hand, we had a dinner last night where we talked about some of these ethical issues, and you know, sometimes these decisions to make somebody CMO happen at arguably inappropriate times. I mean, they could happen at 4 o'clock in the morning. I mean, oftentimes you can drag that decision out to the light of day so you get more people involved and so you can have a more thorough discussion. And the example you gave, you'd want to get a bit more information. This was your baseline set of information. Then you did another scan, then you did a laparoscopy or something, and then you sort of worked your way up to this point. So, I mean, it is a different scenario than the third time redo valve operation. That was a pretty provocative case. I mean, there, in this situation, you're on the line. You got to make a decision now, right? In the third time valve replacement operation, you don't have to make a decision now. You can make that decision now, tomorrow, the next day. You've got two or three colleagues that are in that same group. You know, if someone doesn't like your decision, then they can go to somebody else. The emergency situation is a completely different is different, and I think the principles still apply, the specifics is what separate the two.
Hi, Leah Tatavi. I'm a trauma surgeon in Chicago. Thank you very much for a wonderfully presented and thought-provoking panelist here. I had a unfortunate situation recently of a 25-year-old who was dying of a progressive neurologic disease that was definitely terminal. And she at some point decided that her best case moving forward was to put herself in front of a train to try to move forward. And she came in completely conscious, telling us she didn't want any surgery. She actually had amputated her arm, and she could just survive this, but she said she didn't want anything. Her mother came in waving a pulse, saying, as hard as this is, we fully support her decision. And they did not want to proceed as well. So after getting, I actually have the privilege of serving on the ethics committee at my hospital. We got ethics involved, administration involved. We were lucky, actually able to honor her wishes, and she did pass away. But I recognized there was a lot of moral distress in my staff. I knew every aspect of the case, and I was okay with it, and everybody else was okay. But there was people who had heard little bits of it, and there was a lot of moral distress involved. So we actually did a formal debriefing with the staff. And I wonder just sort of what your thoughts are of how to keep aware of not, you know, us as the captain of the ship, we have to make these decisions, but also what that impact is downstream.
I mean, what a tragic situation. I mean, I think the way these Molst and Pulst and things work is they assume that the person's of sound mind to make these decisions. And if someone's not of sound mind, then those decisions about what to do, they do lose that autonomy if they're not of sound mind. Here, the scenario sort of gets to the second victim thing, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you were involved in the decision, you did all the things you thought were appropriate to sort of be comfortable in your own mind about what the right decision was. You had your team, you're on the same page, you got ethics involved or legal or some combination thereof to sort of say, you know, are we on firm ground in going along with what this young woman wanted to do? Oftentimes the larger team that you're involved with, the nurses, they're not involved with some of those discussions. Mm-hmm. And they can feel terrible about these. And we've had similar situations in our institution. And although the primary doctors are okay, I mean, not happy about it. This isn't a happy
sure.
time,
of
no
course.
Matter how you cut the mustard here. But the more peripheral people involved, they've not had the chance to sort of put their version out there and understand what's going on. And that's sort of critical for this team to be functional, I think.
These are so hard. And it just epitomizes the distress, not just personally for surgeons, but throughout the system. I think your inclination to debrief and circle back is what's key. And what's surprising, you often don't know when it's going to come up again. The nurse says, you know, why are we taking care of this person who's 90 with cancer, and we couldn't help this young person. It goes against, I guess, base feelings. And I think in the absence of knowledge, people will fall back into biases. So I think it's important to keep circling back, keep talking about it, to have real surgical leadership, which is bringing it up again. When you see distress, recognize how cases are different. Try to teach to the nuances as they come up, and encouraging everybody to talk about it.
One of the things that we've tried to do, and with sort of fits and starts, and we've been really kind of blessed that we have several surgeons in our department that have an interest in palliative care, is to have more routine debriefs or just sort of palliative care rounds at least once a month, just there's an opportunity to try to normalize some of what happens. And so it's an opportunity for the residents, the faculty, the nurses to be able to come and talk about difficult cases that are not as dramatic as the example you gave, but to allow us to sort of defray some of that concern for both burnout and for this moral distress.
Thank you.
David Blake in Hartford Hospital. This is an outstanding panel, and I think this almost raises more questions than it answers, I think, for the mass audience. But I would pose a couple of comments and then ask a couple of questions. First of all, I think all the points that you've made about engaging other elements of the team, that is palliative care, ethics, whomever, your members of the multidisciplinary team, I think are key in having some of these discussions. But I would ask you, in an environment where maybe you tend to get sabotaged by some of those teams, and an example I would paint is that you tee up where you sort of get the family heading towards what you think is probably a reasonable decision, trying to honor patients' wishes and outcome and taking into account some of the factors and quality of life, et cetera. You're heading down the road that you think is good, and the next thing you know, palliative care comes in, has a conversation, comes out and says, yeah, they want everything done, you know, surgery, et cetera, et cetera. How would you handle that? And then number two, what do you do when you're consulted by the medicine services to do some procedure on somebody, whether it's a PEG or a trach or something a little bit larger for grandma or grandpa who's been in a nursing home for 15 years and at best case on a good day drools at the windowsill, and family's sort of looking for answers, but they want to do all this stuff to, quote, put her back in a better state into this skilled or nursing facility, basically asking you to come and assault this patient is the way I've interpreted that in some cases, because they've consented the patient and the family, and they just want you to come in and do the procedure. And then when you say no, you come out looking like the bad guy because you're going against the primary doctor's and primary team's wishes. How do you handle that situation? And I'd be interested in the comments. Thanks.
Thanks, guys. No, that's okay. I think I've seen it on both sides as the palliative care consultant and as the surgeon, and I think that it provides an opportunity to get to do some pre-meetings before they start making some recommendations. I think sometimes palliative care makes those recommendations because they don't feel like they have a relationship with a surgeon. I know when I sit through our interdisciplinary team meetings, sometimes that stuff gets fleshed out before it ever gets to the bedside, so I can head it off and explain why just taking out the gallbladder. My other favorite is, can't you just pop a scope in and figure out what's going on? Yeah, like scopes just pop, or I don't know what that even means. So I guess what I would say is after that happens, then sometimes you can use it as we're going to talk about a time-limited trial, as you've heard about, before we do this, or making it very clear that, X, Y, and Z needs to happen. I think to answer the question about it's always a daughter from California. I was a daughter from California. And they're always attorneys. I'm not an attorney. Wants to call in and say, you got to go do this for mom. You got to fix that hernia because I know that's why she's having abdominal pain or why she's not eating, which, of course, is not why mom's not eating, because she's actively dying. But I think it's to sometimes those patients and families need permission, and they need the certainty of a surgeon to just drop the ball and say, okay, this is where we're at. and call things out as we see them, because we're usually fairly plain spoken, and say, what I see is X, Y, and Z, and then that gives them permission to say, okay, we don't have to assault mom and put mesh in her on, you know, right before she dies.
And as a follow-on to that, I think that's a very fair assessment. The follow-on to that would be, though, is when you say no, you've also got to have the support of the bigger institution, that is the hospital and the administration, because I've been, my colleagues and I have been faced with some of those circumstances where you say no, and again, you're the outlier, so you're the bad guys, and family's all upset, and they're taking it to the patient advocate up the administrative chain, and you're kind of getting these conversations about, well, why can't we do this? And it's a matter of trying to educate these folks, but you've got to have that team that's on your side to at least trust in that you can make a good judgment.
So I think that's exactly right, and a lot of this is dependent on the culture in your individual institution. And I think as we all continue to embrace on David's curve of innovation and early adopters, the pendulum is going to swing. And I think you need to find the allies where you can find them, which is often the palliative care team, although in the scenario that you're describing, sometimes they're not. So, I would, just to back up, I think having that family meeting or that goals of care discussion when you get consulted for the PEG or the G-tube, we should be having it. You can have it with the palliative care team or with the MICU physician, but I think we need to convey what this procedure is really about to do. Most families don't understand that getting a PEG doesn't make anybody better. It just allows them to go back to the nursing home and get fed.
But it's always frustrating when patients or their families get contradictory recommendations. I mean, that's always a very difficult situation, because now you go in there and you're trying to backpedal, you're trying to flip them to another school of thought. You know, it's generally better to have those conversations with the other team before someone approaches the family, so they get one consistent recommendation.
Hello, Sarah Lippert, North Memorial, Minneapolis. Little advice here. I just wanted to see what you guys do in this situation. I was consulted just a week ago for a guy with advanced dementia who had filled out his POST form 3 years before when he was clear, didn't want a surgery, very, very clear about it, and I got consulted to do a cholecystectomy. And the family, you know, said that they wanted surgery. So I was having a conversation with them. And so luckily I got palliative care involved and we kept talking to them and we opted not to do surgery on the patient. But what do you guys do when someone, very clear intentions, now they're incapacitated and the family disagrees with the POST form?
I'll start. This happens all the time. I think families are often confused about what their role is. And their role is to speak in the interests of the patient, not themselves. And I think it's really helpful to help them understand that, that they are to convey what the patient would want, not what they would want. So often we now see POSTs, MOLS, et cetera, and the families are unaware of the advanced directives, which is, you know, we all need to have our healthcare proxies in on it. So I think that's a conversation to move them through what's in the best interest of the patient and who they're speaking for. That's my first response. I don't know if others have.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right on that issue, and I think it does take some time to sit down and talk to the family and sort of explain the situation, explain how, as you point out, that they're being asked to make a judgment based on what their loved one would want to do in that situation. I think it's also important to bring out that there may be alternatives. I mean, you know, I think that when I was a resident, everybody got an appendectomy if they had appendicitis, and now some people get antibiotics. There have been other things, cholecystitis. Do you get an operation? Do you get antibiotics? When do you get the operation? I mean, some of these things you can temporize for a while you have these more involved discussions with the family. Sometimes you don't have to decide, am I going to go to the OR today? You can take some time and think about what the implications for those various decisions are.
I'm Christine Keough. I am not a surgeon. I'm married to one, mom of one, and I am a clinical bioethicist with a specialty in palliative care. And phone a friend would also include phone your ethicist. The algorithm at our hospital is if they want to peg for a dementia patient, they have to have an ethics consult first. And I go in and I talk to the family and I explain why we're not going to do that, basically, but why it is that it's not a, you know, she's 89 years old and it doesn't stop people from aspirating and it just prolongs their dying and suffering process. So, and the other thing is when you have moral distress, especially over a patient that dies that's very young, as the other woman mentioned, having a debriefing afterwards is really, really important. I would encourage that. What I notice is our surgeons don't come because they think they don't need it. You need it, and it does
I think it's because it happens at 2 in the afternoon on Tuesday.
We do it around the physician's schedule, and staff will come in for them at 7 a.m. because that's when you people love to meet. or 6:45, that works too. But if you don't go, go ahead and find your ethicist. More and more hospitals have a full-time person like myself with a doctorate in bioethics. I had a clinical background. Go and talk to somebody because it's not good for you not to. You are human. I'm married to one. You are human, regardless of what people think. But it really does make a difference. And when you notice the same thing happening over and over again in your facility, like PEG tubes for people with dementia, if you don't have an ethicist, get your ethics committee involved so that they do. We have an algorithm. If it's for somebody with head and neck cancer, you go ahead. If it's dementia, they get a consult. So I'd just like to emphasize, phone a friend. We love surgeons. You're wonderful. So your
point about surgeons not needing it, you know, that help is interesting. We set up a second victim program in our hospital a few years ago. And for tragic situations like that, we set it up that we had various faculty members that were available for people could go to for help and counseling and reassurance and that sort of thing. And it was across multiple departments. And the people in my department, they never use it. I mean, we look back at who's using that. And medicine uses it fairly frequently. Anesthesia uses it. Some of the other services do. Surgery, practically zero. You know, and part of it is, and some of those we're not reaching out to them, although sometimes we do, but in terms of the surgeons volunteering or asking for that, almost unheard of in our experience. So there are sort of different cultures within medicine, and some groups seem more willing to buy into that than others. So we're thinking with the second victim thing in surgery, do we need to be more aggressive in reaching out to the residents and the surgeons that have been involved with this, rather than them sort of showing weakness, I suppose, and asking for help.
Well, I was told by my senior partner that I had better things to do than show up. It's 8 a.m. before I left the flight from here.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is a lot of times the other surgeons or our cardiothoracic people are that way too. They will find me and I will bump into the person. So that's the other thing that you can do is if you know someone in particular is really grieving over an issue, is go find, whether it's your chaplain, a social worker, your ethicist, go find them and say, hey, you need to bump into so-and-so. They're really having a hard time.
Hi, Scott Cassidy, Kona, Hawaii. And no, it's not paradise. It's actually more like an aid station. So one of the problems that I've seen fairly pervasively in many places that I've been is that care is not always directed towards what's better for the patient. It's not always what you can go home and sleep with well at night. And there's been times when I've been consulted And it's actually been said in those words, we want surgery because it'll be a surgical death instead of being on the medicine service. Or you have it not quite said in those words where you get consulted on a patient, like before I left, an 89-year-old who had been blown off for about 2 years by their health company that managed their care. Rectal bleeding, 40 pounds of weight loss, sigmoid cancer, now obstructing. And I took her to the OR, did a sigmoid colectomy. 2 days post-op, as she's starting to be able to mobilize fluids, now they're talking about comfort measures. She's improving, she's getting better, and they want to make her hospice. Those are the kind of discussions that they should have had post-op. But it is a very similar situation where the patient's outcome was not likely to be good, but they didn't want it to be a medical death. There's been other times when I've been in situations where hospital administrators have come to me and told me that, 2 days post-op after a thoracoscopic decortication for an empyema, that they've gotten all the money they're going to, it's time to let them die now. And then I trached them 2 days later, got them off the ventilator, and I was told it was a prorated DRG. I had to keep them alive for 28 days. So what do you do with those kind of situations? It's a very hostile sort of environment. And I think it's out there a lot more than what you think.
Move to another job. Well, I'm totally serious.
Well, the situations are going to be faced by more members of the college. And if we talk about burnout, if you want to see burnout in the profession, there isn't a better tool for burnout.
Yeah, so I think those are major ethical issues. And I'm not in that environment. So for an administration to interfere with medical decisions is completely unethical. And one has to say no. But if one is not in a position to say no, to advocate for what you think is the right care for a patient, that's a serious issue. I think we all have to be able to vote with our feet if we can.
But even if Scott, and I apologize, I've forgotten your last name, Scott leaves, that doesn't fix the problem.
No,
right?
It doesn't. Because
somebody else will presumably fill that gap, or those poor people of Kona, or any of us, if we're on vacation there, will be in a situation where we don't have access to care. So while my gut feeling was, yeah, you got to leave, this is a terrible environment, it doesn't really fix the underlying problem. And it's a terrible situation. I'm sorry you're in it.
Yeah, I think it does not fix the problem, but I think talking to your colleagues at the same institution, as I'm sure you're not the only one that's having this experience, and it's a medical staff issue. And rallying all the medical staff around this issue would be another approach to really move it forward in the right direction. That would be my other thought, but it sounds really awful.
Anna Berlin, I do general surgery and palliative care, and I just had a comment sparked by the conversation about feeding tubes, but really applicable to a lot of different situations that we face, which is that sometimes we get frustrated when we engage with these problems on the level of the individual cases, individual consultants, individual scenarios, individual service lines, and just to really encourage folks to think sort of system in a systems-based way, and think about what is the workflow and what is the trajectory of a patient before you get consulted on them. So as an example, at Rutgers University Hospital in Newark, we implemented sort of a QI project where patients with stroke who were evaluated by speech and language pathology and found to have aspiration with a recommendation for NPO, that was an automatic referral to palliative care for a goals of care conversation, so that would happen before the consult was made to general surgery. And we found that before that intervention, we as the surgeon were being put in the position of either coming in late to the party, picking up the pieces, saying no, then care, you know, basically we were putting up a roadblock in the care of the patient, and the patient would go to IR or GI for their PEG. So if you think sort of systematically and think upstream of where you are and find allies in your institution to work with, sometimes that can be helpful.
Do we have time for one more? One more. That's good. You're one more.
I wanted to thank everyone for great presentations. I think it's really remarkable that we're now at a time where the work of Gretchen Schwarzy and Zara Cooper and NISQIP risk calculators are being discussed as sort of important preoperative tools in the discussions we have with patients. I was also going to say that I think in addition to sort of phoning friends from ethics or palliative care, that sometimes in situations where there's no good surgical solution, contacting a colleague that might be able to do a temporizing measure, whether it's a percutaneous cholecystostomy or a colonic stent or something like that, might be another thing to think about in these situations as some value added that we can have. The last question that I was going to ask, though, was I think that sometimes we have to have a little epistemic humility and that patients who are in these dire situations can do better than we think. I actually had sort of like a best case, worst case scenario with a patient with metastatic cancer who came in with portal venous gas from an incarcerated small bowel obstruction. And I very much painted a grim picture, but her and her husband said like I've always been fighters and she wanted to proceed. And that was in May and she's still alive in October. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how you do give sometimes people the opportunity to have surgery in those situations.
I had the same case. My partner was out of town. It was his patient, and she didn't speak English, so I had the added bonus of the language barrier. But I think there's still very little downside to painting the grim picture, because then you're just the hero if they come out of it okay, and they are prepared if it's not going to go okay. So I have told patients before, like we all have, we've inaccurately prognosticated in terms of time when they've asked us. I sleep great every time they outlive my prediction. The times when I don't feel good is when I know that I have robbed them of good time to do things that were important to them because we were swinging for the fences and I bunted. So that's a terrible sports analogy, sorry for the baseball fans. But the point is I don't think you have to make any apology, and because the risk calculators aren't perfect, right? So I think you do give them the best answer that you can. And if you'll remember on the ACS NISQIP calculator, there's also the I think my surgeon judgment goes at the end as the little asterisk of yes, I think you're actually higher risk than the calculator puts in, and that's okay. We know surgical judgment works because every retrospective surgery versus non-surgical procedure shows that surgical patients live longer. It just means that we select our patients right. So
I would add that sometimes the best palliative care is doing the surgery. You can relieve symptoms. I mean, putting in a cholecystostomy tube and the patient can go home with hospice for the next 2 months and have a reasonable death and end of life period is a great outcome. So it depends on what the patient's goals are. So it's not just always getting to know. They're not necessarily mutually exclusive. Well, thank you very much. It was a great discussion.